My name is Christopher Peters. I'm running for U.S. House of Representatives in Iowa's 2nd District, so Southeast Iowa, 24-county region. I'm a surgeon by training. I'm a chest surgeon, although I don't do that anymore. I'm pretty much retired from that, but still in a private surgical clinic here in Coralville. I also spent 9 years in the Army Medical Corps as a general surgeon. Own my clinic here. My wife is a nurse and practice manager, I like to say that I own it, but she runs it. And then we have 3 sons as well, 2 of whom are in college, 1 at the University of St. Thomas and 1 at Loras College, and 1 boy still here, sophomore in high school here in Iowa City.
You have run for Congress before here in the 2nd District, and you're running as a Republican, and you're running again. What prompted you to decide, you know what, I didn't get there last time, I want to try this again? What prompted that?
Well, the reasons to run are the same as they were in 2016. The reason we think we can be successful this time is really looking at what we managed to accomplish last cycle. So in 2016, we announced 7 months and 1 week before Election Day in November, and that really wasn't enough time to do the things you need to do to be successful. And despite that, we got a little over 46% of the vote. So I think the message resonated with enough people. And we just, again, didn't have time or resources to reach nearly as many people as we would have liked. So I think we can be successful this time.
What are the qualities and characteristics that you would bring to office?
Well, you know, there's several things that I'm really looking to do with this campaign. One is I really think our political discourse is just degraded, and it's not just in the past 2 years or whatever. It's actually been something that's been steadily eroding for decades, really. I haven't seen the country this divided since the Watergate era, Watergate and Vietnam War era, and I think we're at a place where we need to try to come together as a country. It's just what we're doing is very harmful for our for our country and in every aspect. So I'm really trying to bring a sense of more rational discourse, less polarized, talk about issues substantively, not to be a mudslinger, et cetera. And then I have certain particular issues that I'm passionate about that I'd really like to address in Congress, and I think they are things that are fixable. And one of those is my own industry, which is healthcare. Another is mental illness, which kind of could tie into that as well. And the third also would tie into that, which is care of veterans. There's a bunch of other issues I'm concerned about, but those three are three that I'm particularly interested in. I think there are solutions available if we actually try to find them.
I want to get into those three, since those are the three that you really bring up right off the bat. But when you talk about the political discourse, how do we change that? I mean, especially even from the top, from the administration, the divide that comes up. How do you work to address and try to bring the country back together, in essence?
Well, it's like, I think, anything. Most of our behavior is determined by the kind of the norms that have been established around us, the things that we see. If we see other people littering, we're more likely to litter, et cetera. And again, this has been something that, in my opinion, the discourse has been getting worse for decades. This is not just an effect of the 2016 election. So, being a good example and trying to offer another way forward, I think is huge. And it's not just obviously one congressman out of 435 can make a huge difference there, but you can be the start of something. And so it's just making the effort to make the change. And I think there's a lot of hunger for it, honestly. If I talk to a lot of will-be constituents, they're really tired of all the anger. I think we have to realize that not everyone on the left is a snowflake, and not everybody on the right is deplorable. And let's focus on problems we can actually solve that we need to address, and move beyond the current anger and spite.
And that's what we're going to do right here. Let's talk about some of the topics and some of the ones that you brought up here. And it really, that was actually where I was going to start with you, given your background, is looking at healthcare. Right now, from your perspective, what is the state of healthcare in this country? And How do you improve that? How would you work to improve healthcare in Washington?
So I'm going to preface this a little bit by saying it's going to have to be somewhat short, because you said this is about a 30-minute long interview, and my normal healthcare reform talk is about 30 minutes, so you probably wouldn't get to any other issues. So, but the main problem, in short, is prices of actual healthcare goods and services, right? We focus on healthcare coverage kind of things, but what we really, the thing we really need to be addressing are the costs of actually seeing a doctor, getting a surgery, getting a prescription filled, having an MRI scan, et cetera. Those costs are exceedingly high and rising continuously. And so far, efforts at the federal level have been mostly trying to shift the costs of healthcare coverage around. So you talk about going back to Medicare and Medicaid, for example, in 1965 and up through the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act in 2010, we've been trying to, again, shift the cost of coverage around. I liken it to moving the deck chairs around the Titanic, because the iceberg here is the rising cost of those actual goods and services. And there are, in short, two ways of trying to deal with that. One is through a top-down government decides what things are going to cost, and honestly, we've tried that already, and it hasn't worked. And the other one is more market forces, and I think that's the innovation we're already seeing. We're seeing clinics like mine and the imaging center down the street that offer cash prices for the services at reasonable levels, and they have to respond to what, you know, other competitors are doing, and so we're seeing lower prices. And it's also important to realize that most of healthcare spending, most individual times when you access the healthcare system, they're not for an emergency. You know, they're not for a heart attack or a cancer diagnosis. For those things, you really want insurance. But for most other needs, which are not urgent, which, again, are most of them, we really should be encouraging health savings accounts, use of savings for those kind of routine cares and that routine care needs. And that would help lower prices. It would also make patients much better advocates for their own health. My common joke when I talk about healthcare reform is I ask the audience, what do you think is the least common question I get in my clinic? And they usually get it right, which is, how much is it going to cost? And the most common question is, will my insurance cover it? And the questions we really should be getting are, how much does it cost? Do I really need this? Are you the best guy to do it? Or should I go see the bloke down the block, you know? I think the future is a more patient-centered, market-oriented approach, and I think, I think we're seeing that innovation already. At the federal level, what we can do is greatly encourage high-deductible healthcare plans, which is appropriate for most Americans, and health savings account. We can broaden the audience that would be appropriate for, and one vehicle for doing that would be through a refundable tax credit, something similar to the earned income tax credit. So if you're buying your own insurance, you get or do that with pre-tax dollars. If you fall below a certain income threshold, then some of your premium costs and or healthcare savings costs would be subsidized generally by the taxpayer. But I think that would be much fairer and much less expensive than what we're doing now, which is basically subsidizing the insurance companies to provide coverage.
And that's what I was going to say. It seems, if there's so many people out there that can choose, they choose when they want to go. They don't even want to sometimes go to the doctor. But the low income is one of the questions of how, even if you do try to price it, if you can't afford it at all. So there could be some kind of a provision in there where you maintain some assistance for people who just can't afford it, while giving kind of the marketplace the power to dictate prices, availability, et cetera.
Correct. And there's some additional legislation you could look at beyond that. For example, one proposal, this is not my idea, so I'm borrowing it, but is to pass legislation or a regulation or whatever that says that an individual healthcare provider, whether that be a clinic or a hospital, whatever, if the person is paying with cash out of their own pocket or, you know, with a health savings account, which is the same thing, that the provider can charge no more than they're willing to accept from their lowest paying insurer. So, for example, we see Medicaid patients in our office. If I see somebody that's paying cash, then in that case, I could charge them no more than I'm willing to accept from from Medicaid for that given service. So that would be a way to perhaps kind of force a little bit more cost transparency. I don't think we necessarily need that, but I would be okay potentially with something like that. There's really, even in the hospital environment, most of what is done is, you know, it's fairly routine, maybe necessary, like a knee replacement, for example, but it's not urgent, and there's no reason that in that case, an orthopedic surgeon, an anesthesiologist, the hospital administrators can come up with a price that says, here's what we're going to charge for a knee replacement. Plastic surgeons do that all the time for their elective procedures that they do in a hospital setting. They have to have a bundled price because they're competing with the plastic surgeon in the next town. And so there's no way we can't do that in the hospital setting as well.
You mentioned kind of the couple of topics that merge together, healthcare and veterans care. And one of the questions that people get about veterans care is trying to open it up more, where you don't just have to go to the VA hospital, where you can go to your local providers, where you can do... What do you see as the biggest need when it comes to veterans care? How would you work to improve the care that is provided to our veterans?
And I think that's exactly the model we need going forward, is the veterans for most of their care, they're getting in their communities. One of my friends, he's actually from Clinton County, who I got to know in the campaign last year. He's up here in the Iowa City VA right now. I plan on going to visit him this afternoon. And he's been there for, I think, at least a week, and will probably be there much longer given what he's got going on. And so he's, you know, a couple hours away from home, or hour and a half away from home, getting care. Why can't he get that done up in Clinton County? The VA does have a couple, one of them's called Choice, I think, I can't remember what the other one's called, a couple programs that are designed to do that. But talking to veterans, you know, beginning in 2016 and since, the programs just are not working well. So long view, I think, you know, we should really consider approaching veterans care the same way we do with any other care, you know, high deductible plan, for example, and health savings account, but that would be great for them. That would be a way to make sure they get care in their communities. Certain care that is definitely service-connected, you know, they had an injury or whatever that was due to their time in the service, that needs to be paid for. I wouldn't want that coming out of a health savings account, but it should be done in the local communities. And then another idea, that, again, I'm borrowing all kinds of ideas from other people that are smarter than me, but another idea that I really like is potentially transforming veterans hospitals into centers of excellence for needs that are unique to veterans. So think about amputations, traumatic brain injuries, PTSD, et cetera, where their main focus is providing that level of excellent care. And they could be available to the civilian community as well. But again, routine things like getting a knee arthroscopy or your gallbladder removed can be done just as well at the local community hospital. Probably done better than it can be, at least more conveniently, than it can at most veterans hospitals. And I've worked at a number of veterans hospitals over the course of my career.
A third topic that you brought up right off the bat is mental health care. I mean, obviously, we're sticking in the health care realm. Much of the time you hear of mental health care being, I mean, here in Iowa, the state reorganized, regionalized mental health care. You don't necessarily hear as much about it at the federal level, but what would you look at the federal level? Does the federal government need to step in and do more, provide more facilities, provide more just funding? What do you see as the need at the federal level for mental health care services?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it should be mostly at the state, county, and community level. I think that's I'm a big fan of thinking that local knowledge and experience is much better than what, 435 representatives and 100 senators in D.C. can come up with. But increased funding from the federal level would certainly be something I'd support. The federal government, you know, really kind of dropped the ball, in my opinion, back in the 1960s. They started off with a good idea, trying to get rid of a lot of all the institutionalization for mentally ill people, which certainly was a system that was abused. But then the follow-up plan was to expand community health, you know, outreach for people with a mental illness, and that never really happened. So I'm a little skeptical that they're going to be able to come up with a good plan now, but I certainly would be supportive of increased federal funding, if we can find those funds with a $21 trillion deficit, to help states and communities do that. I bring it up as an issue because those three issues were probably three of the most common things I heard in 2016, and that may have been a little bit of, you know, bias, selection bias, because I'm a doc, but mental health care by far and away was the most common question I got in 2016 was, what do you want, what are you going to do about mental health care? And then, of course, everybody's concerned about health care, and, of course, I have a lot of veterans in the area concerned about those. So those are not my only issues. I don't want to be branded as a one-trick pony that all I care about is health care issues, but those are just the things that my constituents, or hopefully future constituents, ask about tremendous amount of the time.
And I've got a whole list of other topics here, so we're going to kind of try to get through a number of these as we discuss. And one of the things, I mean, it comes out each month, the jobs report, the state of the economy right now. Unemployment is at as low a levels as it has been in a long time, but there's still people looking for work. There are still businesses that need people to work. What would you do in Washington to help spur job creation in the country and in particularly the Second District of Iowa?
Yeah, I don't believe that government directly can do much to create jobs apart from looking at what things they're doing that are hindering job creation. So things like excessive regulation, licensing laws for certain occupations, there are a lot of things, but most of those are done more at the state level. Making sure the economy, you know, is doing well generally is about all that government, especially at the federal level, can do. You know, business cycles come and go, and I'm not really convinced that the government's particularly adept at modifying those. I think we should be just very happy right now that employment is incredibly low, and it's really a good market for people looking for jobs.
Another issue that has surfaced recently involves Facebook. Congress has held hearings wanting more privacy, the selling of information. What do you think that Congress's role should be? Should Congress require more regulations of Facebook, other social media companies to protect that information? Is that Congress's role?
You know, I don't... I'm not sure. I'm on Facebook. You know, we have a campaign page. I have one for our page for our clinic and one for me personally. I'm concerned about the privacy issues somewhat. I certainly don't like what happened with Cambridge Analytica, but it sounds like in that case they more or less stole data from Facebook. It wasn't a permitted use. So I am concerned about the privacy issues. Of course, there is certainly the option just to opt out. I haven't given that subject probably enough thought to come up with a clear decision, but I'm more inclined to believe that people and markets will respond to changing demands. If people are concerned about Facebook privacy issues and leave Facebook for MeWe or no social media platform whatsoever, I think Facebook will be forced to respond to those concerns.
Another issue, and kind of bouncing around from here to there, there's the talk of the president meeting with the leader of North Korea. Is it a good idea? Do you think that is a good idea for the president to meet with Kim Jong-un and have a summit, I guess, in better words?
Well, I think everyone, or I shouldn't say everyone, but a lot of people, at least in my little universe, is pretty excited about what's happening between North and South Korea. And so I think anything that moves that process forward to decrease the risk of conflict on the Korean Peninsula is a good thing. I don't think we know enough about what details and what things are planned for a potential summit between the two leaders, but I'm encouraged. I'm very optimistic. I hope it'll pan out to be something good, but I guess we'll have to wait and see. But yeah, again, without knowing specifically what they're talking about, and do they have any, you know, pre-summit goals in mind, that's going to depend a lot, or the success can depend a lot upon that work done beforehand.
And kind of staying in that part of the on that part of the planet, do you have any concerns about the U.S. relationship with China? I mean, it seems all of a sudden One thing is said, tariffs are increasing, then China's retaliating, talk of a trade war, farmers are worried, manufacturers are worried. Do you think that do we need a better relationship with China? Do we need, I mean, a relationship, I guess you could even somewhat say, with China?
We clearly do. I mean, they are a huge trading partner. It's been, you rightly pointed out that a lot of Iowa farmers and other people in associated agriculture industries here in Iowa are very concerned about the potential for a trade war and its effect on their viability. And it's better to have a good relationship with such a economically powerful entity than a bad one. I think there are justifiable concerns regarding how China does a lot of things regarding trade. In the past, Donald Trump had talked about them being currency manipulators, but certainly they have, they've justifiably been accused of violating intellectual property rights, stealing secrets from industry, for example. State support of industries there to make goods that are cheaper, so they're more likely to be imported by us and other countries, for example. But there are mechanisms, like through the World Trade Organization, to address those kind of concerns in a better fashion than I think tariffs. I'm generally not a fan of tariffs at all. But going into negotiations on trade with China directly. Would be, and again, working through existing institutions like the WTO to address really some serious concerns would be a much better model forward.
As we kind of said, there's so many topics you can discuss in only a limited amount of time, so try to bounce around to get a few more and get your thoughts on a few more. Immigration, there's always the talk the president wants to build the wall. Do you support the construction of a wall?
I support making our border as secure as it reasonably can be, but it's all going to come down to, I'm a surgeon, so I'm a risk versus reward kind of guy, cost and benefits. So how much is it going to cost? How effective is it going to be in different areas along the border? It's going to be probably not a wall necessarily like is sometimes talked about, but fencing or remote surveillance. There's a lot of different options. So I'm for keeping the border as secure as it can be. I just want to see what what the costs are going to be and what the best estimates of how likely it is to be successful, be effective at doing what we want it to do.
The Farm Bill is obviously an issue that's important to you in Iowa, and it's important to people in Iowa. A provision of that revolves SNAP and food stamp program and possibly adding work requirements for that program, or more work requirements for that. Do you feel that that is a good approach when it comes to these social safety nets to add in these types of work requirements if people are, you see it at states doing it and then talk of it at the federal level?
I've not seen work requirements proposed for SNAP. Has that been out there?
I've seen a couple of mentions of it, not just something that's going to be possibly discussed as even the idea of implementing that.
Right. I haven't seen it, so it would really depend upon the specific proposal. I think people do have, concerns that some people are getting, a handout that they don't need or don't deserve. It's also important to keep in mind that these programs are an incredibly small portion of our federal budget. So I guess I'm a lot less concerned about that than I am about kind of wasteful spending in generally, especially given our $21 trillion deficit. That said, individual programs is depending upon what is actually being proposed. If they want to know that people are looking for work in order to get benefits, I could potentially be supportive, but it's really depend upon the details. But again, these are really fairly small programs in the large scheme of things.
Kind of bouncing back a bit, we touched on healthcare a bit, and an issue that's in the headlines and discussed a lot is what to do with opioid abuse. You hear a lot of times of overprescribing or ease of access to getting it. How does Congress get involved in that? What needs to be done from the federal level to address this epidemic?
Yeah, I should have tied that in with the mental health issue earlier as well, because substance abuse in general, it's a big. They oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes go hand in hand. And like with the mental health illness issue, I think it's going to be something that's going to be probably best handled at the state and community, state, county, community levels. But increasing access to funds for those programs from the federal level is something I could certainly get behind. You know, I think there's a huge concern here in Iowa, and I think every state in the union, regarding the opioid epidemic, and I'm concerned about it as well. But again, I think we know the things that work, right? Medication-based treatment programs to help people get off opioids or whatever their drug habit may be. Needle exchange programs to make at least that safer from an infectious disease point of view. Providing actual health care, mental health care in the communities, as opposed to what we're doing all too often now, which is have incarcerating people rather than actually getting them treatment. So we know the things that work. Carrying around opioid antagonists to reverse overdoses is something as well. So again, it's not really a question of what should we do. It's just let's get busy doing it.
What do you think of the special prosecutor looking into the Trump administration, the 2016 election, and it's every day there seems to be something new with that. What do you think of that?
You know, I'm with everyone else right now. I don't have any inside information. It's just an ongoing ongoing story that shows up. Not having any particular inside information, I don't know the veracity or not of any of the various concerns. So again, I'm just following along with everyone else. What's going on? I lived through. I was young then when Watergate happened, but I lived through that. Of course, Bill Clinton's problems as well. It's a little hard for me, who's a guy who likes to know some facts before I make a decision here. I don't know much, so I kind of just hold off and wait and see what is reported. Seems like something new is coming out every day.
Do you have any concern running as a Republican, even though the president is not going to be on the ballot? It seems almost that it could be a referendum on him. It's a midterm election. Any concern with him not on the ballot, but kind of lording over the ballot?
You know, not really. I'm not running for president, so I'm running for U.S. House, and I'm running against a particular person in a particular district. So this is all about my visions, my ideas of things that I want to accomplish. I don't think it has to do with the party so much. I mean, could there be some blowback, some concerns? Sure, but I think our focus is, here's who I am, here's things I want to promote, here's Dave Lobsack, who's going to be my opponent in November, here's what he hasn't done, which is a lot that he hasn't done, or I should say the way is very little that he has done. And this is our district. How do we appeal to a broad cross-section of those voters? It's been a couple months since I looked at it, but I believe it's probably still true that there's about 20,000 more Democrats than Republicans in the district, but about 20,000 more independents than Democrats in the district. So key is really to, you've got to reach a broad section of voters. You cannot just say, I am a Republican, therefore vote for me. You got to offer something different, and I think we do.
Probably the final topic to try to get in here is a lot of push for Congress to address guns, be it banning certain types of weapons or access to weapons. Do you think Congress needs to take any of those steps to ban who can have weapons or to ban certain weapons? Does Congress need to take any more action on that?
I personally don't think so. As I mentioned already, I'm an Army veteran. I'm a gun owner. So I'm broadly supportive of the Second Amendment. It's just part of who I am. That said, I'm also a physician. I'm also a father of three boys, as I mentioned. And I share the concerns of people who don't want to see things like mass shootings, whether it's in a school or other venue. But the problem there, again, is not so much, in my opinion, the tool. It's the person. And I think we've, going along, I think a lot of these things like mental health and opioid addiction, and the recent study showing that Americans, especially young Americans, are lonelier than ever before, and gun violence, I think we've got a culture problem much more so than we do with the gun problem. And I think there's a lot we can do to address that. That includes everything, you know, from being a good parent to volunteering in your neighborhood, in your community, to mentoring young people, to toning down the divisive rhetoric, whether it's political or otherwise, that we see. We need to come together better as a country to fix a lot of these problems, and that includes the gun violence issue.
We have covered a number of topics. Is there any topic, a key topic to you, that I haven't asked about that you'd like to weigh in on?
Boy, you're going to leave it open-ended. I got to think about, is there any issue I haven't talked about or you haven't asked about?
Because I'm sure there's plenty of them that we could get into, but is there anyone that you kind of really expected that we would have time to get to that I haven't thought to ask about yet?
No, I kind of had no preconceived ideas what you'd ask, honestly, Jason. So I'm used to just kind of taking whatever as they come. I think long-term, one big issue, and they kind of actually kind of go together, but is our spending and our debt. It's an issue we've got to come to grips with at some point. $21 trillion is the current debt and rising. Rising rapidly, we have to kind of really come to grips with what kind of reforms are we going to do to address that. Because I personally think leaving future generations with a checkbook that's that so solidly in the red is not a good plan. Debt is going to be the one thing that we, as I think as our generation, really needs to begin addressing, and no one seems to be really talking about it in a serious fashion.
It doesn't seem like that's, it's so large, you can't cut your way out of it. I mean, how do you even start an issue like that?
Well, I think you need to decide whether you want to even have the discussion. I personally do, but it's, and a lot of Republicans will give it lip service, but then not go beyond that. The half the budget, over a little over half the budget, goes to just two things, which are Social Security and healthcare. Those are two things. We've already kind of addressed healthcare spending already. I think that we can reduce the healthcare spending proportion and do something that's much more market friendly and again patient centered, and it would be less costly. And long term, I think we also need to look at Social Security, whether that's going to be a sustainable program. Is this due to run out of money? I believe in 2036, I think, is the year. To reform that is going to require either, something to reduce benefits, which, of course, seniors aren't going to like to hear at all, or increasing taxes on people working, which, of course, people working aren't going to like at all. And more likely, it's going to be some combination of both. But if we really want to start addressing these long-term program sustainability issues and addressing the debt, which, again, I think is a huge threat, a huge millstone to be leaving around the necks of future generations, we got to start having a serious discussion about it.